Hi, my name is David.
We'll start with the basics. I teach theology at Fuller Seminary. I love what I do. And I'll say this for the two seminars that I'm doing, one on eulogies and one on curse psalms, that they both connect to a book that I have coming out in March. And so this is the table of contents. So just to let you know that today's discussion I cover in greater depth in a chapter on anger and a chapter on enemies, because the curse psalms overlap both those themes. So it's the topic that I'm interested in. Let me just tell you quickly a backdrop comment. About 20 years ago, I wrote a thesis for my THM at Regent College, and I was investigating Jesus' miracles of healing of the physical body. That was my project. And in my research, I discovered the work of an anthropologist named Mary Douglas. And her work caught my attention, captured my imagination, and one of the things that, well, her basic project is to look at the role of taboos in certain tribal societies. And in that discussion of taboos, she explores the nature of the relationship between sacred and profane. And so then I found that it was her work was helpful for me to make sense of the taboos around bodies that were injured or bodies that were disabled or bodies that were broken in particular ways in Israel's life, Israel's religious life. And for those reasons, they were not allowed into temple spaces. And so I brought those two fields into conversation, but it did spark my interest in this nature of profane language as such. I was raised in a conservative, evangelical, Protestant world, and we did not use colorful words. And I remember I was raised in Guatemala, and we moved to the States when I was 13. We moved to North Shore, Chicago, Deerfield, and for one of our school outings, we went up to Wisconsin to ski, and this was my first time to ski, and so I didn't know what I was doing, but when you're 13, you try to pretend that you know what you're doing, because the girls, and so I went down a black, which I don't advise, because I didn't know how to go down a black, it just seemed like that's what cool kids were doing, and within 2 seconds, I fell, and then tumbled. And then the thing that just kept coming out of my mouth as I was tumbling was the F word. And I never in my life said the F word. It was just like, that was the worst thing a Christian could say. But it was the thing that just kept erupting from my mouth. And I got to the end of it, and I was in pain, but I was really embarrassed that I had been, I was like, how was that in my heart? But it was, and so that was when I was 1985, and so many years later, I start writing on this question of profanity. And I got really interested in how the language of profane exists in relationship to these other terms that we use, like swear words, cuss words, obscene words, expletives, and thinking, where do those words come from, linguistically, historically, social, culturally? And then it lands me into the Psalms of anger. And what I'm sharing with you is half a finished product and half a work in progress. So I'm going to try and go somewhat swiftly through the material so that we can have some chance for you guys to ask questions and to tell me that I'm colorfully wrong. So let me just move somewhat swiftly through the opening parts and get to the profane part. So this is, oh, can we turn the lights off? I think the lights, yeah, were off, just so you guys can see this. This is a talk I gave at Fuller Seminary, which is where I teach, about a year ago, actually. Kirk Franklin, I'm not going to go into the details, but whatever. He was at the Dove Awards, and he accepted an award, and then in his acceptance speech, he mentioned a desire to pray for a black man who'd been shot and wanted to pray for both his family and it was the woman. It was the woman who was with her nephew, and to pray for the police and got a lot of pushback on it. And so he expressed in an Instagram video his anger at that experience. And then I saw on Twitter, Monday, October 28th, New York City, a day of outrage in honor of this woman. And then I happened to be watching the Two Towers. Is that the Two Towers one? The Two Towers. And where this is one of the ancient trees, an Ent, and he's with the two hobbits. And this is the first time the Ent tree is seeing the destruction wrought by Saruman. And he says something, do I have this here? I don't think I have it in my notes, but he says something like, there is no curse in Entish or the ancient tongue or the tongues of men that could accurately describe the evil that this has brought. I thought, oh, that's so interesting. There's no curse in any language that would befit this evil deed. So that was it. And then I was driving around town and I saw this. If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. So then I basically say lots of things make us angry in the world. Rebecca Traister, a couple years ago, published a novel, called Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. So I've been interested in anger because that's my besetting sin. I've struggled with it my whole life. It's a generational thing. And so I've tried to make sense of my own anger as a vice, but could anger become a faithful thing? And that's where the curse psalms have helped me out. Black Lives Matter, Me Too, the abuse, sexual abuse of by priests, Catholic priests, of children and nuns. The movie The Purge. If we want to save our country, we must release all our anger in one night after the Las Vegas shooting. And Our Age of Anger, an article in Time magazine. Americans have made something of a fetish of our rage of late, a fact that's even been leaking into our language. The base is never just animated, it's always enraged. Healthcare debates are never spirited, they're always furious. In the run-up to the 2016 election, a CNN ORC poll found that 69% of Americans reported being either very or somewhat angry at the state of the nation. Bernie Sanders, I am angry, and millions of Americans are angry. So in a normal talk, I'd slow down and comment a little bit more. But this was my way of paying attention to what's happening in our society, which is, in fact, an uptick in anger, an uptick in angry language. In fact, an uptick in what's called war speak. So words that we would normally use to describe, small disagreements might be now described as skirmishes. And so the war speak is starting to reshape the way that we perceive the world, we perceive our neighbors, we perceive our political opponents, rather than say adversaries. They're now enemies. So the enemy language and the angry language, the war speak language, are mapped onto each other. And so this is where I became interested in the ways in which the curse psalms might become useful to us, might become actually God's provision for us to actually be angry, like fully, fully angry, but fully, faithfully angry, and where we might actually have holy permission to curse. And that's the argument that I'll make. Now, C.S. Lewis argues that the curse psalms have no place in the life of the church. He says one way of dealing with these terrible, or dare we say, contemptible psalms is simply to leave them alone. And St. Clive is wonderful. We love him, but on this, I disagree with him. So then, at this point, we get to the curse psalms. Okay. So I went to counseling therapy for many years when I was in my 20s and 30s, and my therapist told me something that has stuck with me. He said the whole history of humankind can be described as a movement from sad to mad to bad. You get hurt because somebody said something to you, did something to you. It hurts your feelings. It makes you sad. So that's where the Psalms of Lament, that's the category that they occupy. If it hurts acutely, if it's a sore spot, if you feel that you were taken advantage of or abused in some way, it'll make you mad. And then at that point, so his argument was this is healthy, normal human experience, but it's at this point that we make a choice. From our sadness and our anger or feeling upset, that we then can make a choice whether to do, say, bad, just do something that would harm, and the harm can be something that you commit against another, or you can harm yourself as a way of flipping God off. So that's that. When you do yourself harm, it's a way of giving him the bird, as it were. So I found that helpful because it's true. And I was a pastor for 10 years, and everybody in our congregation had sad, mad, bad issues. I had sad, mad, bad issues. Okay, the basic shape of the curse psalm. So let me slow down here. Here would be a typical example. Let's see. This is the dominant pattern, but there are exceptions to the pattern. Angry psalms, which is what I'm calling them, curse psalms or imprecatory psalms, are a subset of lament psalms. The curse and imprecatory psalms are lament psalms exponentially felt, or to the nth power. So they're lament, but experiencing this in these acute, extreme ways. So, help, O Lord, for there's no longer anyone who is godly. The faithful have disappeared from humankind. They utter lies to each other. With flattering lips and a double heart they speak. That's the complaint. The petition, may the Lord cut off all flattering lips, the tongue that make grace boasts. And then the response is, you, O Lord, will protect us. You will guard us from this generation forever. On every side the wicked prowl, as vileness is exalted among humankind. Okay, here are some of the thematic concerns of the curse psalms. The first thing to say is the Psalter opens with language of the God who judges the wicked, and it closes with language of the God who judges the wicked. So whatever else the imprecatory or curse psalms are on about, they are always on about God. So the argument that I make in the book is that the psalms give us permission to weep and wail our hearts and bodies out. They give us permission to curse and to be angry, but it is always before the face of God. So when things get askew or go afoul, or we get into trouble, is when we're not actually addressing ourselves and our pains and our angers at God. Psalm 1:6 is at the beginning, for the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. And then towards the very end, the Lord lifts up the downtrodden. He casts the wicked down to the ground. Psalm 149 also picks up the language of the wicked as well. The second thing that you notice is the presence of enemies in the psalms. The German scholar Eric Zenger says this. He says, the people who pray the psalms feel themselves surrounded, threatened, and shot at by a gigantic army, or they are like an animal pursued by hunters and trappers, or they see themselves surrounded and attacked by rapacious wild beasts, trampling bulls, or poisonous snakes. Even in psalms that express a lyrical underlying mood of confidence and trust, or a joyous harmony with life, there are sudden eruptions of shrill disharmony, recalling enmity, persecution, and hatred. So there's this rich collection of metaphors that the psalmists use to describe their experience of being on the receiving end of harm or potential harm. As difficult as it is at times to resist the desire to get revenge and to give people who have done wrong what they deserve, I suggest to you this resisting is exactly what the Psalms invite us to do. They don't deny our anger at being wronged, but they do deny us the right to take vengeance in our own hands. It is in this sense that the Psalms of anger are essentially prayers of relinquishment. Now, I think Psalm 139 offers itself as a basic pattern for how we might pray the curse Psalms. First movement, do I not hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? Am I not aggrieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. This is the kind of language that has caused Christians and theologians and pastors for 2,000 years to feel very uncomfortable with these psalms. Can we, in good conscience, sing them, pray them, preach them in worship? And the answer has largely been no. Second movement, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. So we experience a certain anger or rage at those who would do us harm, but in the end, we also name ourselves as those who are potentially among the wicked. And the wicked in the Psalms are just a shorthand for those who would defile, dehumanize, destroy God's good creation. Number three, where the people are oppressed, the character of God is at stake. So what the psalmist in these imprecatory psalms is saying is this world is your idea, God. This human life is your doing, oh God. If you don't do something to stop the wicked from destroying it all, it's your reputation that's ultimately at stake. So don't let it come to nothing. Don't let the suffering be meaningless. Deliver us for your name's sake. This is something that Christians for centuries have been trying to say to God. Now, here we go. We're going to come to the topic of the day. The experience of violence inevitably provokes hyperbolic, profane language as a way to express the shocking violation of God's good order in his world. Okay, let me go with Psalm 109, one of my favorites, one of the great lullabies that you sing to your children at night. When you think about your enemies, may his days be few, may his children be orphans and his wife a widow. May his children wander about and beg. May they be driven out of the ruins they inhabit. May there be no one to do him a kindness, nor anyone to pity his orphaned children. May his posterity be cut off. May his name be blotted out in second generation, and may his memory be cut off from the earth. He loved to curse. Let curses come to him. He did not like blessing. May it be far from him. You may have friends like I do. I have some good, close friends whom I love, both who love Jesus and both who don't call themselves Christian, who have used this basic pattern of language, but it's just one F-bomb after the other, where you find yourself so enraged because you find yourself so profoundly hurt, whether it's an injustice or something that was done by a family member, that you find yourself erupting this volcanic anger. And you're basically saying, F you and F you and F you and God damn you. But in some sense, I will say that phrase in our company here, the Psalms are in fact giving us permission to agree with God that certain things in the world are in fact damnable. The evil that destroys and corrupts is damnable, is essentially what the Psalms are offering to us. So here's Mary Douglas's book, Purity and Danger, an analysis of concepts of pollution and taboo. Okay. What she argues is every society arranges itself around an orderly system that enables it to thrive. And she calls this system of self-organization purity, hence her term. It's a very technical term. But let me suggest to you that all the language that we find that's similar in the Gospels around purity and even in St. Paul is more closely related to this idea than don't go and look at that movie or don't go listen to that song because it'll make you impure. Impurity is more of a technical theological term rather than something that maybe we in 21st century America think of as purity culture issues. So purity is about what enhances life, like justice and honesty and clean water and the making of hospitals. And it is about what hinders life, like injustice and deceit and unsanitary bathrooms and the making of sex slaves. So the opposite of purity in her argument is disorder. So while purity is related to order, it is also related to holiness. The holy space is a space of wholeness and thus also of life. And to step outside of this holy space is to step into profane space. So when the tabernacle and the temple are built, the interior domain of this space is intended to represent this Edenic environment, this Edenic ecology, this Edenic cosmos, where everything is in its right place and therefore everything is flourishing. In Israel, the leper is excluded from the inner spaces of the temple, the architectural symbol of Eden, because he represents an image of disorder. Because of his physical mispicturation, he therefore belongs, for religious theological reasons, on the outside. And the term profane comes to us from the Latin profanus and suggests the idea of being outside the temple. So inside, quote-unquote, temple spaces, things look a certain way and we speak a certain way in a way that coheres with the order, the, if you will, the shalom, the, where everything is rightly and beautifully related and flourishes as God has intended it to be. And profane space is the opposite of this holy or whole space. Now, in technical terms, it is what she calls dirty space. So you have this, it's a technical term in her argument. It's where you become dirty rather than clean. And obviously, we have taken those terms to use them in different ways, and we have used them to do harm to one another. But the language of dirty words, in fact, comes originally from this, if you will, tribal world where things are on the inside and things are on the outside, and things that are clean and whole and coherent and well ordered and everything is as it should be, is guarded by these taboos. And so when you step outside of this order, then you are in this profane space, this disorder, this chaotic space, this dirty space. And the function of profane language is to give us the ability to express uncommon, disordered, and undesirable experiences. So if I'm a carpenter, my father's a woodworker by avocation, and if he... you know, makes a table or a rocking chair or a rocking horse, then nails go inside wood and hammer goes on nails. But if the hammer goes on his thumb and he yelps a colorful word, that's his way of matching language to experience. Hammers aren't supposed to go onto thumbs, or certain wars in our American history have been regarded as 100% unjust, which was certainly the case for many during the Vietnam War. And so both advocates and protesters during that time called it an effed up war. And that word was used to basically say, if there is such a thing as just war, this is not what that is, and therefore it is an effed up war. This, I think, is what's happening in our curse psalms. The psalmist is using this kind of profane language in order to give expression to profane experiences that violate the dignity of the human person and of God's good purposes for the world. I'm going to just go a little bit deeper, and then we'll bring things to a close. Suggest to you that there are three categories, basic categories around which profane terms can be grouped. This is historically speaking, most human societies. Words related to sex, word related to bodily functions, and to the divine or God or something that exists out there. The three categories are protected within most tribal groups by taboos. And this is done, I suggest to you, because sexual things or excremental things or divine things are seen to possess uncommon power to both bring order in life, but also to disrupt order and life. Now, whether the power is positive, such as the life-giving power of Yahweh, or negative, or devitalizing, such as demonic powers or institutionally corrupted powers, the person who behaves in a careless manner towards the taboo puts himself or herself in danger of affliction, illness, or death. So most tribal societies will organize themselves around these kinds of arrangements. Now, the decision about what counts as taboo is often arbitrary, as you well know if you thought about it long enough. And this is, and what is socially permissible barometer for what is offensive and what isn't fluctuates with time and circumstance. So, for example, in 19th century America, the word leg, as in leg, was considered indecent. The proper linguistic surrogate was a limb. I have a limb. I am in proper society, and I have two limbs. Hollywood banned the term virgin for many years. A hussy was once simply a shorthand for housewife. And a bitch is, in biological and scientific terms, a female dog. A screw can mean one thing in a hardware store and another thing in the locker room. Now, in the end, the universal concern in all societies is for the protection of the community's life. And taboos are simply one way to ensure the people's general welfare. To address the taboos for all societies is believed to lead to disorder. It does not always lead to disorder, but it is believed to lead to disorder, confusion, and the collapse of society. All right, this is the last thing I'll say about this before ending with the anger psalms in general. The psalmist, I argue, uses profane language in the curse psalms in order to keep himself, herself, from profaning the world by chaos-inducing actions. That is, I speak profanely so that I might not act profanely. And in a liturgically sanctified space, the psalms are saying we can do this, much to the surprise of most of our church cultures. All right, lastly, imprecatory psalms point to a way out of slavery, to revenge, and into freedom of forgiveness. Psalm 137, it's the by the waters of Babylon, we sat down and wept. That's the nice part, that's the part we can sing. And then it ends with which part? The part we don't sing, that which shall not be named. The babies, that's the babies, okay. So for 2,000 years, pastors, worship leaders, liturgists, Christians have excised that language from its repertoire. So we have not been singing those because we have not known what to do with them. But we are wrong to do so, argues the Croatian-born theologian Miroslav Volf, who insists that psalms such as these remain within our devotional practices. Why? Because such psalms may point to a way out of slavery to revenge and into the freedom of forgiveness. Now that's easier said than done, right? If you are a worship leader, you're like, no thanks. But I argue that Christian practices that are devoid of this demanding psalmic language leave us vulnerable to theologies and practices, pastoral practices, that are incapable of dealing with the experience of anger that so easily leads to violence, with its systemic multi-generational reverberations played out both on the public scene and in the privacy of our own. And there is a chance that you know somebody who has experienced physical abuse. So is there a place for somebody who's been on the receiving end of that to say out loud in the presence of the people of God, to the face of God, how angry they are? That's my point. Here's what Wolf says. Rage belongs before God, not in the reflectively managed and manicured form of a confession, but as a pre-reflective outburst from the depths of the soul. By placing unattended rage before God, we place both our unjust enemy and our own vengeful self face to face with a God who loves and does justice. And then he says, hidden in the dark chambers of our hearts and nourished by the system of darkness, hate grows and seeks to infest everything with its hellish will to exclusion. In the light of the justice and love of God, however, hate recedes, and the seed is planted for the miracle of forgiveness. If you have ever been hurt by somebody, whether stranger or deeply known, and they actually intended to wound you, and it touches a sore spot in you, there's a chance that you will react. And your reaction will be visceral and unthought through, and your singular purpose will be to destroy them. Because you're so profoundly wounded, because you felt like your own vitality, your own life has been crushed and deemed dishonorable and unworthy, that you find yourself with this desire to the hellish will of exclusion. We see that on social media all the time, all the time. This is how Wolf concludes. It is not safe simply bottled up in my own heart, all this anger, this rage, this desire for revenge. It's not safe in some public space of venting our collective feelings. It is safe in the space where it is placed before the one God of both those whose children have been dashed against the rocks and of those who did the dashing of those children against the rocks. So like the psalmist, Wolf is saying we bring all ourselves because we are always at some level those who are hurting and being hurt. This is Bonhoeffer's caution to us. He says the imprecatory psalm leads to the cross of Jesus and to the love of God, which forgives enemies. I cannot forgive the enemies of God out of my own resources. Can I get an amen? Only the crucified Christ can do that, and I through him. Thus, the carrying out of vengeance becomes grace for all men in Jesus Christ. In this way, the crucified Jesus teaches us to pray the imprecatory psalms correctly. And then he follows this with saying, unless you have reckoned in the depths of your inner life, your soul, your bones, with what Christ has done on the cross, you have no business praying these prayers. You can't, because in fact, you will be undone by them. You do not have the resources in you to pray them well, to pray them faithfully, healthily. You must, you know, place yourself at the foot of the cross. Lastly, Aristotle, anyone can become angry. Yes, that is easy. But to be angry with the right person to the right degree at the right time for the right purpose and in the right way, this is not easy. Yes, which is very similar to what St. Paul said, speaking King James English. Be angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. Eugene Peterson, the Psalms show us how to cuss without cussing. And I end with this. I think this is the invitation of the Psalms, to have an honest heart, an open heart, a transparent heart, a vulnerable heart. Such a heart is honest to God about one's feelings. A hardened heart wants only to exact an eye for an eye. An honest heart entrusts one's enemies to God. A hardened heart demonizes one's enemies. An honest heart is angry before the face of God in the presence of the community, while a hardened heart hides from God and perpetually finds a community wanting. What the Psalms invite us always is to choose this honest, vulnerable, transparent, and this is broken, wounded heart that we might stand before God and the people of God and be healed. Okay, let me pause there. We have about 20 minutes-ish. Those are some thoughts on profane language as it relates to the curse Psalms. I realize these are ideas that are largely aspirational. I actually gave a version of this talk to a group of 250 clergy, and their one question was the same. How do we do this? And I said, I have no idea. I hope you guys can figure that out for me. But we had a wonderful discussion of ways that it actually could be done well, contextually, carefully, all those sorts of things. So let me pause, and I welcome your thoughts, questions, and other things. Yes, ma'am. Hi. Thank you.
I just came back from Israel, and did a trip that we visited Palestinian Christians. Mm. They were constantly oppressed by the Israelis, and doing really unjust things. Mm. Like they own the land, they try to recover the land, they have all the legal documents, they cut their water and then the electricity and all that. But this Palestinian Christian, in his farm, at the entrance, he had this big stone that says, "We refuse to be enemies."
Mm.
And he was telling the story from Hong Kong.
Mm.
And if you guys pay any attention to what the Hong Kong police is doing for the protesters, I tell you, I identify every single thing of these people using legal means to oppress.
Mm.
So I felt myself enraged.
Mm.
But in the end, he led us. I don't want to leave you guys there.
Mm.
I want to come to how we still try to, we refuse to be victims, he says. We refuse to be vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
We refuse to, and then they take active measures. We want to claim justice through legal means. And they still want to do a Christian thing. And, I just found myself in tears, coming up. So I tried to understand how they do this.
Mm.
And also read this other, this other Palestinian Christian wrote a prayer for each psalm. And I looked for 137, asked, how do you pray? And I understood that he said, he looked at evil.
Mm.
But more spiritualizing.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. You're not my enemy.
Mm-hmm.
The real enemy is that yeah. behind you, that mm-hmm. evil. Mm-hmm. So instead of demonizing mm-hmm. the person, mm-hmm. he sees that evil behind the person. Mm-hmm. So his anger is towards that spiritual realm, mm-hmm. so that he could be angry still.
Yes.
But and yes. loving the person behind. So that was what I. Sort
That's
of
good. Yeah. Well, in a sense, I have a relatively strong conviction that the Psalms are one of the most psychologically intelligent book of poems you'll ever find, because it understands how human beings are made. And if you've ever done therapy or counseling or psychological work, you will know that part of your healing is naming things accurately, that you must name the things that you have experienced. Otherwise, those things that you leave unnamed because you've ignored them or suppressed them, have a greater chance to become toxic within you. And so you're actually, in fact, not healed. You're not whole. You're not free from these things that would threaten to sneak in through the back door and turn you into a version of yourself that is less than holy and whole. And so I think the Psalms are giving us permission to name these things and to name our feelings about these things, to be able to say, no, 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 no. No. And then simultaneously, as it were, because it may take days, months, or years for you to get to that place of resolve and entrusting and relinquishing yourself. But eventually, you relinquish, you cede your everything to God, and then Jesus invites you to bless your enemies. So there is this, we name our enemies, and we bless and pray for our enemies. But, you know, for most of Christian history, we haven't had these resources at our disposal in liturgical ways. We haven't had them in devotional means for us to be formed and habituated to be the kind of people that would say, oh, it's completely normal for you to weep in public worship or if you become angry in public worship. Largely, those things would cause us to be mortified. We'd be embarrassed and walk away from the person who was making a scene. But there are other cultures, obviously, that are much more attuned, much more habituated, much more at home with expressing those things. But conversely, the Psalms are not asking us to indulge. So that's, you know, ignoring, suppressing, and indulging are the two extremes that we're trying to avoid. How you do that well is always a pastoral and contextual thing. But I think at some level, yes, we say, enunciate, articulate, express, and then we are invited into that place of loving, or seeing our enemy as Jesus sees them. So, okay, there was a hand. Okay, Daniel, and then we'll go to the back.
Can I make a comment and then get your reaction?
Yes, you may.
So, one of the popular postures of worship music today is invoking the Spirit's presence. Mm. Mm-hmm. And so I got curious and just kind of tried to go through Scripture and find all of the actual language of that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so what I've started to do, and I'm working out trying to figure out how it works in this practical sense of how to mm-hmm. do this,
yeah.
is leverage the already, or maybe appropriate this culture of invoking spirit mm-hmm. and worship and use that as our entry point into, we can't do that without mm-hmm. also mm-hmm. asking for his justice, which
yes.
sometimes means calling out against our
yep.
enemies.
Yep.
I guess I'm wondering if my observation is accurate.
Yes. Answer. Yes. If I may, I wrote an entire chapter about justice in the Psalms and the conclusion. My sister is what you would call a justice person. And let me say it gently. She's a justice person. I don't want to say she's a justice person. She just feels fired up about justice. I'm not. That's like something I have to grow into. It's not part of my background. It was not part of our common devotional vocabulary. So it's something I've had to choose to grow in, and that means having friends that can help me understand that and challenge and encourage me. But I love discovering something that I had not seen in the Psalms, because my tradition was largely the interior piety of our lives was central, and the public social component of it was secondary or or not relevant, right, to our faith, but then discovered that there is no faith, no faithful prayer without justice. They're just at every corner in the Psalms, there is a request, a petition. And if that justice is ultimately God's justice, and if Jesus is the one that supremely shows us the just one, then the Spirit is the one who enables and empowers us to be like Jesus, the just one in the world. So every time we do invoke the Spirit, we should be invoking the Spirit of Jesus Christ. Yeah, and so then that reorients us away from whatever tendencies we may have in, say, Pentecostal directions or quote-unquote non-Pentecostal directions that sort of compartmentalize the Spirit only doing one thing. But certainly the Spirit is rather interested in comprehensive things as the author of creation. So
the terminology of reveal yourself, which is largely accepted in the worship, mm-hmm. the song world, mm-hmm. can be reappropriated for something.
Yes.
Else as well.
Yeah, I would think the answer would be an obvious yes, but it's not obvious. That's the thing. It wasn't obvious to me, right? So I needed help from others to see it, and then this study was a wonderful invitation to really feel it deeply and to think, how do I need to change as a teacher, as a priest, as a friend, so that I can be a part of the work of the Spirit to bring justice to the earth. Yeah. Okay, gentlemen in the back. Oh, yes. His basic point was, unless you have reckoned in your bones, in your heart, with the crucified Christ, you have no business praying them, because it's like a nuclear weapon. You do not know how to handle it. It's a power too great for you to hold with your human hands. So it is only Christ by Spirit that can enable us to pray these and not be warped. Because I have been asked, if we give people permission in liturgical spaces to pray these things, will it not feed their desires for revenge? Will it not aid and abet their revenge-tinged fantasy worlds inside their imaginations? And my answer is yes, that's the risk. So it's a pastoral work to train our people to do it faithfully rather than nursing our anger by indulging this, you know, secret weapon of the curse psalms.
And is all of this in your book?
Most of it is, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have it in two chapters because I talk about anger sort of in a sequence of chapters on emotional health that I think the Psalms invite us to occupy. But then I treat its enemies separately because I had to reckon with the fact that the Psalms are awash in enemy language. So, yeah. Yes, sir. Hey, Ron.
So in the third famine, do you think it's saying we should all, because the name of God speaks of all that he is, we should just use it like we do in the temple, in other words, in worship,
uh-huh.
and not use it in profane ways.
Right.
In common ways.
Right. But you mean taking the Lord's name in vain?
Yeah.
Are you asking me what I think about taking the Lord's name in vain? I'm not an Old Testament scholar. I think my simple answer is that we don't play fast and loose with God's name. God is not an object, an it that we can manipulate and then use, weaponize to then do harm to the world that God has made. That would be sort of my most comprehensive sense of don't take the Lord's name in vain. Rather than, as a kid, it was don't say, oh my God, right? Don't say, oh my God. The irony, of course, is Latin American culture says, oh my God, all the time and nobody blinks. Ay, Dios mío. Ay, Dios mío. And it was completely normal and faithful and holy. And it was like what beautiful Christians did to say, oh, it's snowing. Ay, Dios mío, it's snowing. But in English, oh, it was just such a different thing. It was like
Christians or
non-Christians? Oh, Christians. Oh, totally. Yeah, Christians. Yeah.
But they're really thanking God.
Well, so it was very similar to like soccer players crossing themselves when they get onto the soccer pitch. It's like, you come on, you dug the grass, and you did this. And for us growing up as evangelicals, that was just complete 100% superstition. But in my older age, I began to think, well, I wonder if that's just a way of saying that all of the earth is God's. And so this is just a public symbol to say, as I go play soccer, God is with me. Now, I'm not saying every soccer player has that thought in their heart, but I would think that perhaps verbal and physical sort of signs become a way of saying the whole earth is the Lord's. And so to say, ay Dios mío, is a way to say, ay Dios mío with ice cream, ay Dios mío with snow, ay Dios mío with worship, okay. Whatever it is, ay Dios mío, God's everywhere. And that's just a lovely way of naming his presence with us in all circumstances. That's Latin American evangelical culture, radically different from Dallas Theological Seminary culture.
That was, if I may, it comes from some of the indigenous pieces, right? The indigenous understanding of land, of everything being integrated, not this separation of soul and body and land, but everything is integrated, right? So if everything is integrated, it all comes together.
Yeah.
God is a part of every single thing. Had the earthquakes going on, we had a meteorite that landed, you know, it's apocalyptic, right? And so we have all of this, and what are we supposed to do with all of those feelings? And so it's okay to be angry, and we do put it along with lament.
Mm-hmm.
We just had services where people have found it very helpful and very healing be able to have services of lament that allow you to bring both your lament, your sadness, and your anger. It is natural to feel anger when there's such loss. It's a way of fighting back. If you hold your anger in, it turns into depression. And it becomes self-destructive. So it's okay to curse God because God can handle it. I do it because I'm in relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
And I care about my relationship with God. And I'm making this reclamo. I'm claiming out to God and I'm saying, hey, what is up with you? When do we get a break here? Hello. And that's okay for me to say to you in a relationship, in a close relationship. It's about the intimacy of the relationship and the wholeness of all of those pieces. So I don't have to make this, you know, a profane thing so I can't have my anger. Who else am I going to bring that kind of anger to?
Right.
You don't want that kind of anger coming from you. I definitely don't. So who can handle that? Well, I know that God can. And so what better way to do worship than, because worship is about relationship, right? Spirituality, relationship. So what better way to say that I believe in God than to bring that to God? To say that I believe that you are in the end a God of love than to bring that to you. What a better way to do that than to bring my enemy to you so that I don't end up doing what I really would like to do to my enemy. What a better way to bring that to you and then release it there to you, right? But there has to be, when you're leading the worship, you are guiding people about the intention of the heart and why it is that we're doing that. You are guiding persons in doing that. And then it becomes a healing piece, a releasing piece, a place where then you go from anger to tears, and the tears begin to wash those places, right? And then all of this that's been there, you can now release it. And now what happens? What is it filled with? Yes, now it's filled with the Spirit. Now it's filled with what God would really fill me with in that moment. God has taken these other things that have gotten in the way of my being able to see the love of God, my being able to have faith. Now that's been emptied out. And now I am refilled, still in the presence of God, right? It's a journey in the liturgical piece. It's a journey. It doesn't take an hour. It doesn't take 45, you know, American minutes to do this. It doesn't. It's a journey. It's communal. It's everyone. It's the Spirit crying out in gemidos indecibles, moans and groans of the Spirit, right? And the moans and groans of the Spirit are not just sadness, but they're part of the anger, of the reclamo, of the I want justice, Jesus. Right? It's all of that. But you have to understand what it means to do that as a community and not just as an individual. Right? And that is a different liturgical movement. Everyone doing that together and caring and holding each other in that moment when we're doing it, right? And those who are doing the singing of those songs, they're taking care of our souls in that moment. Right? You're not just singing. You're taking care of each other's souls together. You're in this together. You're helping each other to cry, to take it out, because we can't live with that from day to day.
That's good. Thank you. Let me just say, to complicate my argument, we have to be able to answer the question, if we get angry at God, are we being disrespectful? Like, that has to be answered. Is it a sign of disrespect? Or is it a sign of unbelief? That if God is sovereign and all-knowing, and something has happened in the world that is harmful or wrong or a loss, are we then doubting God in some way? Todd Billings, who teaches up at Hope College, or Western, right? Western, up in Holland, wherever that is. He wrote, I thought, a very helpful essay for Christianity Today answering that question. But I think he's answering it for a very particular audience who would worry that if I were to express these thoughts and feelings to God, that I would be disrespecting and disbelieving. And so we have to at least reckon with that question carefully and then offer an answer, which may or may not be more or less helpful to some over others. But, okay. There, yes, sir. Yes.
Aware of any worshiping bodies that are incorporating
Yes, I actually am. There is an Anglican church in Greensboro, North Carolina, who's developed a number of liturgies. Missio Alliance is a coalition of folks, and on their website they have some liturgies drawn from the Cursed Psalms that were in response to things that have happened over the last number of years. Few and far between, the Psalms for All Seasons is a hymn book that was produced by the Institute here that has settings for all the Cursed Psalms, which I think is quite wonderful. I think certain traditions that do a lot of call and response worship are especially suited to handle some of these psalms, because you can put on the lips of the congregation certain words, but not all words easily. And so the cantor or the spoken word artist or the hip-hop artist may do that part, like speaking on behalf of the congregation. So I think depending on the context of the church, they may or may not find an easy entrance.
I'm questioning what, as you say, people who are actually doing it, you know, hymnals are full of things that are well-intended and say, who's going to do that?
Yeah.
If there's at least one, that's good.
Yeah, well... here you go. Those are two resources. This is the setting in the Psalms for All Seasons for 109, which is wonderful. I suggested matching Mary's Magnificat to the language that it draws from in Psalm 94, which is far more visceral, far more sharp-edged. You could do a responsive reading, and then you really hear the sharp-edged nature of Mary's Magnificat. And then, yeah, here we go. Look at that. Ha-ha. I have it here. Missio Alliance. Then I have, I don't know. It was a different talk that I gave. But yeah, just giving examples. There you go. It was in the slideshow. Let me just see if there's anybody else before I go back to you. Anybody else? Anybody else? Anybody else? Anybody else? Anybody else? Okay.
Okay.
No worries.
Last question. I wonder, and this will be probably theological, more biblical, that say if we New Testament believers are given the spirit of Jesus Christ,
yeah,
and we are children of God. And do you find New Testament examples of using the imprecatory Psalms in the New Testament? I mean, they're, you know, some of the Psalms,
yeah,
you know, the argument has become, you know, obsolete because,
sure,
we are in the New Testament.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, there are many parts to an answer to that, so let me just say one thing, which may or may not satisfy. But the one thing to say is, if our assumption is that we can only say or do in corporate worship the things that we see said and done in the New Testament, then most of our worship doesn't actually look like what's actually in the New Testament. So that's sort of the cheeky way of saying it. But if we can assume that the New Testament body of believers worshipped in ways that remained integral to the tradition that they had inherited, namely the Psalms. And I think scholars offer a rather convincing argument that the first century church did use the Psalms as they had been using the Psalms. They saw no reason to stop. Now, they had to do a little bit of a Christological transposition on some of them, perhaps, and they're no longer a city-state nation, as it were. So they're a nation of a different sort. So there's some recalibrations. But if we can assume that the early believers continue to worship in the way that they had been worshiping, whether largely from synagogue context or if, you know, you did a pilgrimage to the temple, then the answer is, of course they use the Psalms. Like, the onus of the argument is on those who would argue that you wouldn't.